Okay, the next mitzvah, the mitzvah we're going to do today, is mitzvah number 3 in the Torah, the mitzvah of Gid Hanasha. Now, just to summarize briefly, the last 2 weeks we discussed, the first week we talked about the mitzvah of Purvu, being fruitful and multiply, and then last week we talked about the mitzvah of Brit Milah. And we're kind of a bit weaving a connection between the first two, and we'll see how it connects to the third one. The first mitzvah we described is kind of the universal mitzvah, right? This is to Adam. This is before there's any Jewish people, before there's people in the plural, right? There's Adam and Eve, and that's it. So they receive this mitzvah. And it seems it's much more universal, and certainly it becomes our mitzvah, but it's a mitzvah that we learn out from this universal concept of be fruitful, multiply, and conquer the world and fill it. And then last week we talked about the first mitzvah meant for the Jewish people specifically, the mitzvah of Brit Milah, which is meant to bring about, you know, a sense of a commitment, a sense of uniqueness, and really is singling out this people in a very significant way. And we talked last week about how and why the mitzvah does that. But I think we'd all agree that the first two mitzvot are mitzvot that are pretty well known. And if you have to list the importance of mitzvot, they'd be pretty high in the list, right? The mitzvah of Purvu, of having children, is a universal and very basic concept and a basic value of Judaism. And the mitzvah of Brit Milah also is something that we'd all pretty much agree is universal, well-known, practiced, you know, pretty much by everybody. It has a very clear significance in the history and in the practice of the Jewish people. The third mitzvah in the book of Bereishit, the third and the last mitzvah, is kind of like, you know, which of these is not like the other, which of these just doesn't belong. This one just doesn't belong. Okay? We've got this obscure mitzvah that for even the most ardent followers, it's still somewhat of a mystery. And it's something that's practiced, but very often people aren't sure exactly what it is, why it is, and where it comes from. But certainly it doesn't seem to fit in with the other three, right? The prohibition of eating the sciatic nerve, the Gid Hanasha, is definitely one of the more obscure mitzvot that we have. Not one of the more well-known ones, not one of the more, it's not learned very often. And certainly you wouldn't equate it, as far as prestige, okay, with the mitzvah of Purvu and the mitzvah of Brit Milah. But we're going to take it just as seriously, and hopefully we can not only get a sense of what it's about, but also get a sense of why this is mitzvah number 3. Now, we can't necessarily learn very much. We'll see as we go through the mitzvah. We can't necessarily learn that, you know, mitzvah number 7 is not more important than mitzvah number 123, right? It doesn't really work that way. But the first three mitzvah that are appreciated, I think you can give a little bit more significance to, or at least try to see why we're learning these mitzvot from these stories. Now, one of the main questions we asked last week is the mitzvah of Brit Milah is learned out from a story. It's learned out from a story of Avraham, and then Yitzchak as well. So that's what makes it unique, is that it's one of the few things that our ancestors, are the Avot, the forefathers, the Imahot, the matriarchs, do that become a mitzvah. Now, most of the things, pretty much everything else that our forefathers and matriarchs did, don't become mitzvot. And it's probably a good thing that some of the things they do don't become mitzvot, because not everything should have happened or happened the proper way. I mean, you know, there's a lot of stories that we have in the when it comes to our ancestors that have a lot of different sides to them. But here we have the second example of it. And it's a fascinating case study. So what we're going to start by doing is just reading the story in the Chumash inside, because we can't understand this mitzvah at all until we get a sense of the story. Then we'll kind of branch out and see how this becomes a mitzvah, why it becomes a mitzvah. And then at the end, we'll get into a bit of a practical side as to how this mitzvah is practiced and what it means today. The most famous application of this mitzvah is filet mignon. I just had this conversation with someone Monday night, and they're talking about their wedding. What's it called? Their wedding. Their menu for their wedding, and they asked about different meats. And they said, "Oh yeah, why isn't filet mignon kosher? what's the deal, right? Because if it's from a kosher cow, a kosher shechli cow, then why is filet mignon not seen as a kosher thing? So we talked about it a little bit, but we'll get into that in a little bit more detail. And we'll get into some of the history of it as well. It's not so simple to say that it's not kosher. We'll see why it's not, you know, practically eaten that much, and what else we'll get into that as well. There's one more of these. Oh, let's get into the story. Let's start there, because that's where everything's going to flow from there. All right, we're on page 174/175 in the Stone Art Scroll Chumash. I'll read it in Hebrew and then in English. So let's start with 23, Chaf Gimel. Vayakam balayla hu vayikach et shtein ashah v'et shtei shivchotah v'et achar asa yiladav v'yavor et ma'avar yabok. Vayikachem vayavireim et hanachal vayaver et asher lo vayavater Yaakov levadeu vayavek ish imel ad alot hashachar. But he got up that night and took his two wives, his two handmaidens, and his 11 sons, and crossed the ford of the Yabok. And when he took them and had them cross over the stream, he sent over his possessions. Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until the break of dawn. Vayarki lo yacholo yacholo v'yiga b'kaf yerecho v'teka kaf yerech Yaakov b'heva koimo v'yomer shalcheni ki ala shachar v'yomer lo asher lechecha ki'im berachtani. Vayomer lav mashemecha vayomer Yaakov vayomer lo Yaakov yamer od shimcha ki'im l'Yisrael kisarita im Elohim v'im anashim betucha vayishal Yaakov vayomer yidena shemecha vayomer la ze tishal l'shmi vayrech oto sham. Okay. And then we skip down. We'll do the English next. Okay. So he wrestles with this man, and the man is unable to defeat him. So what does he do? So he struck the socket of his hip, so Jacob's hip socket was dislocated as he wrestled with him. Then he said, "Let me go, for dawn is broken." And he said, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." He said to him, "What is your name?" He replied, "Jacob." He said, "No longer will it be said that your name is Jacob, but Israel, for you have striven with the divine and with man and have overcome." Then Jacob inquired and said, "Divulge, if you please, your name." And he said, "Why then do you inquire of my name?" And he blessed him there. So Jacob called the name of the place Peniel, for I've seen the divine face to face, yet my life was spared. The sun rose for him as he passed Peniel, and he was limping on his hip. Therefore the children of Israel are not to eat the displaced sinew, the Gid Hanasheh, on the hip socket to this day, because he struck Jacob's hip socket on the displaced sinew. So a mysterious story, and an enigmatic story, and somehow at the end of it, we don't eat filet mignon, okay? So it's a bit of a jump. So, okay, let's get to the story itself. According to the Torah's depiction of the account, who is Jacob fighting against? Using only what the Torah says. What information does the Torah give us?
He's fighting with the design.
Okay, so somebody's fighting with the divine.
It says it's a man at the beginning.
Okay, so it's a man, but divine. So what does that lead us to believe? What are we talking about?
An angel,
right? Just like we have the story of Abraham, when the three angels come and visit him, and yet they're portrayed as people, right? So too, here it seems we have an angel. Why is this angel fighting him? That doesn't seem very nice. We don't know.
He wants to be blessed, right?
So after Jacob wins the fight, then he wants to be blessed, right? So it's his...
But how did he know he wanted to be blessed if he didn't know he was an angel then at that point?
So he obviously figures out at some point this is an angel, right? Because obviously, exactly, he figures out at some point that this is not normal, something's off here. And therefore he wants to be blessed, and then he gets the blessing of a changing of his name from Jacob to Israel to Yisrael. Okay. Now, famously, what is this angel? How do we understand this angel? What do we understand this angel to be?
Death?
No, well, most commentators understand it as being
evil.
It's kind of the angel of Esav, right? That's what ends up being kind of the perspective most commentaries take. This is Esav's angel, the divine aspects, his guardian angel, something to that effect. Okay, so we have here is his. Now this is.
But if it's his guardian angel, why would he wrestle him?
Okay, so that we have to understand. But what's going on here? Now here we have just the context of the story is right in the middle of his encounter with Esav after many, many years, right? Jacob grows up with his brother and then he has to flee his brother after he tricks him out of the blessing from his father. So he flees and he goes to another country, raises a family, gets married, has 4 wives and 13 children, gets wealthy. Now he's returning back to Canaan, returning back to Israel, and he's anticipating the encounter with his brother, right? To a certain extent, he initiates the encounter with his brother. So, first he prepares for that encounter, then he has this episode with this angel, and then he encounters his brother in the physical world. So this is somewhere in between. This is part of the process of him preparing to meet his brother. He goes through this process, and then he gets his name changed, and then he gets injured, and then this becomes part of the Jewish people. So again, it's a very unique story because it's so enigmatic, and then it ends up in this mitzvah, which we don't really see besides the story of Brit Milah. But the story of Brit Milah is so clear, right? Hashem says to Avraham, "Have a Brit Milah. This is the purpose of it. This is why we're doing it. It should be for future generations." Avraham does it, and then it goes passed down from generation to generation. Here we have, at the end of this strange story, a mitzvah thrown in. Yaakov was hurt in this way, and therefore it becomes prohibited to eat from the sciatic nerve of an animal.
But it doesn't say where it comes from.
Where what comes from?
The commandment, the mitzvah, it just sort of comes out of nowhere.
Yeah, exactly.
The mitzvahs come from that.
Well, it's written in the the third person narrative, right? Therefore, the children of Israel are not to eat. It's almost like the voice of God narrating the story, right? And therefore, right now we assume God tells this to Yaakov, and that gets passed down.
Now, how can you translate that person to an animal?
Ah, good question. Right, Yaakov was hurt. Okay, great. What does that have to do with eating animals? Yeah, exactly. Okay, good question. Good question. Okay, so we'll hopefully get to that. What?
It's an obvious question.
Yeah, that's insulting to Tommy. Oh, that was a good question.
All right. It's a brilliant question.
don't know that.
It was so obvious, how come he's the only one who asked it? Okay. So let's understand this story a little bit. Now, what's going on? So let's say we understand this to be some sort of the angel of Esav. Now, when we think about Jacob's life, how will we characterize Jacob's life? What things come to mind when we discuss Jacob's life? Give me a few things to describe it.
He was cheated out of an inheritance, a blessing from his father.
And then, but then he got it back, right? So,
well, I
okay, so I work with that. Okay, so does that become a theme of his life?
I think fighting is a theme because he has to kind of fight for a lot of things.
Okay, so
I don't know if fighting is the right word, but I will
struggle.
Throw it out there.
Okay, he has to struggle. Okay, he's got to struggle for his role in the family, right? He's got to struggle his brother to get his rightful place. Mm-hmm. He's got to struggle with his father to prove himself, and then he's got to struggle with his father-in-law, right? And then he's got to struggle with his brother again, right? So his life is always in conflict. Maybe that's a better word. So he's struggling, he's always in conflict. Okay, what else would you describe it?
In a way, he's always ends up being blessed.
He gets blessed a lot.
Yeah.
Okay, he gets blessed. Beginning, he gets blessed here. Okay.
He basically prevails.
He always prevails. Okay. So he struggles, he has conflict, but he triumphs in the end, right? In the end, he beats out his brother. In the end, he beats out his father-in-law and is able to accumulate what he wants to accumulate. How does he triumph? What tools does he usually use to triumph?
He fights back.
Okay, but... Okay, so usually he's tricking, he's outsmarting, he's being a little bit... Right now, when it comes to tricking his father, it's not really his idea, it's his mother's idea. But even before that, when he tricks Esav, you know, into selling him the birthright, for a bowl of soup, so he's tricking his brother. Then he tricks his mother, or his father, and then he gets tricked by his father-in-law, and kind of tricks him back, right? So he's constantly involved in trickery. Okay. Okay. So we have a life of struggle and conflict. He gets blessed a lot. He struggles, but he triumphs. He always ends up winning. There's one time we're not so sure he wins. And that's when Yosef is taken away from him. Right? Even though Yosef is alive and he sees him again, we wouldn't say he won there. Right? He seems to be the biggest loser of that whole episode. Yosef ends up making it, the brothers move on, but Yaakov is just a shell of himself, really, from that point forward. And he's always involved in trickery. His sons trick him as well, right?
Yeah.
His sons trick him when they say it was goat blood. You know what I'm saying? When they dip in goat blood, and, you know, he was killed savagely. It was an accident, right? His own sons end up tricking him. So his whole life he's involved. Every episode somehow is involved with trickery. Lovin's always tricking him, so he gets tricked a lot as well. It's a very interesting life. Not only does he triumph, but what is his role in the history of the Jewish people? Right, we have Avram as the first Jew. How would you characterize Yaakov, Jacob's role?
Well, two things. One, he gives us the name Israel.
Okay.
And the second is he's the first one whose children all inherit rather than just getting passed down.
So okay.
End up with the tribes, which creates the people.
Okay, so he's the transition from individual to communal, right? Because Avram to Yitzchak is just, you know, one person takes over. Yitzchak to Yaakov is one person takes over. But right now we're just breaking even, right? Yaakov is the first one. Now there's a multitude, right? And they grow quickly. So now we begin to have the transition from just an individual or a small family to a people. This is when that process takes place. So Yaakov, we're having that transition from individual to peoplehood. Or to a nation.
Already? Or just a tribe?
A tribe to a people to a nation. I don't know what the thresholds are for, but this is the beginning of that process. We're now beginning to see it open up, right? And then when they're in Egypt is when they really become become a nation in the end. Okay. So how does this story fit into Yaakov's life? Now, we have to not only talk about his life, but his relationship to his brother and what that represents. Okay? Now, what does Esav represent, both himself and in the future?
Kind of a physical wildness.
Okay, so Esav is more physical, wild, and Yaakov is more intellectual, more cunning, more right, and more passive to a certain extent. Okay. What else? I'd also say, you know, Esav's life is always about the here and now. Right, Yaakov's life is always about what's happening in the future, right? He gets married very late. He doesn't have any guarantees from his father until very late. He gets married, he finds the girl of his dreams, he's got to wait 7 years, right? And then he waits another 20, he ends up living with his father for 22 years. And then he finally gets to Israel, starts his life, and then the son who he thinks is going to be the next generation, the leader of the next generation, now he's shipped off to Egypt and he thinks he's dead. His life is always like living for the next step, and the next step never quite turns out the way he thought it would. Esav never seems to be concerned about that. Asaph just builds, you know, step by step. He's really living in the moment much more. And not really as concerned about the future. So, Yaakov and Esav end up becoming kind of a battleground. The two of them really are a struggle, but their struggle ends up representing the Jewish people struggling against other nations of the world. Right? And the ideology of Judaism versus a lot of the ideologies that are going to be out there in the world. So, to this point, how would you characterize the struggle of Yaakov and Esav in the Torah, besides this story? Right, the very what kind of struggles are they? Are they physical struggles or are they philosophical struggles?
It's a philosophical struggle.
How so? I would characterize it more as a physical struggle. We're having battles for supremacy, right? Literally, when they're in the womb, the Midrash says, right, that Yaakov and Esav were fighting to see who comes out first. Because they know whoever comes out first will get the blessing. So they're fighting. Esav beats him out, right? They're butting heads. And even, Yaakov's not scared that Esav is going to philosophically or intellectually defeat him. He's raising to kill him and his family, right? With Esav, it's, you know, you're battling the, you know, the raw physicality and intensity of Esav against Yaakov, who really just wants to live a more peaceful intellectual life, right? And that's a constant struggle here, right?
Yeah, but did he trick his father to get the blessing? No.
Yes, Yaakov will use cunning, but the struggles that they have, I mean, they're butting heads, right?
He's cheating his brother out of something.
Yeah, no, I know, but it's a raw battle. It's a battle of.
But it's physical on Esau's side, but it's more intellectual on Jacob's side because he knows he can't beat Esau in a fair fight.
Right.
So he's using cunning to defeat his brother.
So you're right, but what's he trying to get out of it? I mean, he's not trying to convince Esau to live a different life.
No,
right,
no.
That we don't.
He's trying to save his own.
He's just trying to survive. He's just trying to save his skin. He just knows he has to do it in a way that he can win, right? But the battle itself is just a battle for survival. It's not much more than that. Now, to a certain extent, you could argue that the one who wins their philosophy will win out, and that's true. But their battles are always very physical, right? Even though Yaakov's focus is not in that way. But how does Yaakov have to win? Yaakov has to win with cunning. Yaakov has to win, right, struggling. And then Esav, you know, so like you said, Yaakov has to use his cunning to beat Esav's raw strength. Okay. Now, does that reflect, how does that play out in Jewish history?
Well, we have to survive, too.
So how do Jews survive?
By very tricking people.
I won't go that far. Right? Meaning Jews have always had to outsmart right?
Another one.
Right? We never had, or very rarely in history, have we had the physical strength to overpower anyone.
Wait a minute. Mm-mm. How about Samson?
Samson. There are examples. But
David was also pretty...
Yes, again, there are examples. There are pockets, but for the most part, Jews
Moshe
have
Dayan.
What?
Moshe Dayan. It took only 7 days to beat the
I know, people. Sandy Koufax. We can quote all of them. But I'll put it this way. The fact that we can name them so easily tells you something, right? You know,
there's plenty of cases when Jews use physical force to it.
No, the Maccabees and I mean the right. There's a story of the Maccabees that's physical strength, and the story of Purim where it's more cunning and intellectual strength, and they're not. There's a little bit of both.
They used physical strength, but it was not a superior physical strength. It was an inferior physical strength, which due to a better strategy.
Right,
won.
That's true. Right, right. And the story of the Maccabees is a small militia defeating a big army because they outsmarted them. Right. That was the. Remember when I was in the basketball team in high school, and we go up against these guys who are bigger and stronger and faster than us, You know, so we walk out in the court and look at the other team. We're like, oh my goodness, we can't win this game. So, like, you know, so our coach would be like, you have to outsmart them. We're the Jewish team. You have to outsmart them. You know, like, I don't know what we can do here. We're not that smart. Yeah, okay, great. We'll outsmart them, and then they'll dunk on us. we smartly got out of the way when they dunked on us. So here, this is interesting. Okay, so the reason I bring this up is because I want to compare and contrast this story that we just read with the rest of Yaakov's life and the rest of his struggles with Esau. So, number one, who is he fighting?
Esau.
Right, but he's fighting the angel of Esau, right? Or an angel that represents Esau in some way. So he's fighting the divine in a physical way. It's a strange balance, right? Typically you'd think you fight the physical, you fight the divine or the spiritual with spiritual.
That's
right?
Why he said there was a spiritual struggle. He fought an angel. How do you fight an angel physically?
Right. So he's fighting the spiritual physically. And how is he how is he fighting him? How would you characterize this battle?
Wrestling.
Head on. Right? So that's different than the rest of Yaakov's fights, right? Typically, Yaakov is not fighting mano a mano. They're not wrestling on the ground. He didn't wrestle Esau, right? The last thing he wanted to do was wrestle Esau. And now he's wrestling Esau. What's the imagery? What do you think that means?
It's shadow boxing.
Okay. But meaning...
And he got his head busted.
It's actually a fight that I would call it a struggle to beat his brother to be able to survive.
Right. So now for the first time, and remember, he's about to encounter Esav, the real physical Esav, right? And he's been afraid. He's been afraid of him. And so now, in preparation for that physical battle, he's fighting the spiritual battle head on, right? Butting heads. They're wrestling on the ground. I mean, you can't get more raw or more raw physical battle than this, right? And yet with the spiritual side. So we have a raw physical battle against a spiritual entity with a person, Yaakov, who we would characterize as a more spiritual person than a raw physical person, right? So you can imagine this is a field day for commentaries. What this is supposed to represent, what this is supposed to mean in the future. So there's a midrash. That what he was battling was that Yaakov was battling the prince of Esav, right? And then basically, he was battling the parts of Esav he was jealous of, right? That as happy as he was with his life, Esav had gained certain successes, right? And when he encounters Esav, Esav has a whole army behind him. Esav's building a nation. Esav's building, and he ends up becoming a nation. Esav becomes Edom, which becomes Europe, which becomes Rome, and the Roman Empire is all seen as like from the line of Esav. So this is a very significant person who builds a very significant empire. So while Yaakov is proud of what he has accomplished, he's there are parts of Esav that he wish he had. Right? And like anybody or any group of people, there's always things about other groups of people or other, you know, other individuals that you wish you had. So what he's fighting here is he's fighting his own demons to a certain extent. He wants what Esav has. He wishes he could do it like Esav does it. It's easier for Esav. Esav can just take what he wants. Esav can just bully people. Esav can just, you know, move mountains when he needs to. Yaakov has to maneuver and struggle. He has to be patient. Yeah, it gets a little tiring after a while. Yeah, sometimes you'd rather be able to just take it when you want it. So to a certain extent, there's certain parts of that he's jealous of, and that's what he's battling. He's almost battling his inner demon. He's battling the parts of Esav, kind of the philosophical things about Esav that he wishes he had himself. So that's one perspective of this story. The other side, and this is the Midrash Lekach Tovin, the Ramban discusses as well, is that there's a great significance to the fact that when this angel is fighting Yaakov, he ends up injuring him, right? Why does he injure him? Why does this angel injure Yaakov? Is the way it's described is he realizes he can't win, right? What does he say? When he perceived that he could not overcome him, He struck the socket of his hip, so Jacob's hip socket was dislocated, and he wrestled with him. So he gets in a last cheap shot. Right? He gets in a cheap shot. He realizes he can't defeat him. So he ends up just trying to hurt him a little bit, and hopefully... What does he hope is going to happen from that?
He'll let go.
He'll concede, or at the very least, he can't conquer him, but he can make a mark, right? And sometimes that's your only goal, right? Sometimes you're not going to win this war, but if you can make a mark, if you can make an impact, you feel like you've accomplished something, okay? So the Ramban brings this down, and others as well. And this is reminiscent of the way Jewish history is going to play out. That time and time and time and time again, the nations of the world are going to think that they can dissuade or convince or force the Jewish people to give up their religion. Right? They can philosophically battle the Jewish people head on and either convince them or intimidate them or conquer them in a way that they give up their Judaism. And that's every country we lived in and every nation we've lived with and everywhere we've been. At some point they've thought, you know, we can do something here. Right, and when they realize that they can't do that, so what do they do next?
Bust their knee. Yep.
Right. So then they'll kick us out of the country. They'll start pogroms. They'll start to kill people. They'll start to force us to convert. Right. They'll try to do something. They'll see they can't win this war, but they'll try to hurt us in a way that it impacts us. Right. And even who knows if Hitler really thought he could kill all the Jewish people. But he knew he could make a dent. He knew he could send a message in his way. And that's his message. His message is, all right, I couldn't knock you all out. But I could do a lot. But I could do something. Right? And he did it, you know, and that's, in his sick, deranged mind, that's what he did. So, that's what this battle is. This battle is Yaakov going up, not against the physical side of Esav, which is what he usually battles. He usually battles physically. Now it's spiritual Esav. Now it's the Esav that in the future is going to try to convince Yaakov and Yaakov's descendants to change, right? And when they realize they can't, they're gonna kick him in the thigh, and they're gonna try to injure them in a way so at least they make an impact, and hopefully that wears down the Jewish people over time. When Yaakov sustains that, fights it head on, takes the injury and keeps on ticking, and then wants a blessing in return, so now his name is changed. Right? Why now is his name changed? What's the significance of this? Right? So now we at least have a sense of what's happening here. So what's happening here is now Yaakov is becoming not just himself, but he's becoming Yisrael, this is the beginning of the nation. Right? To this point he's been the individual Yaakov. Now Yisrael represents him as the patriarch of the Jewish people and the beginning of this nation, and right, that what do we call the Jewish people? Bnei Yisrael, right? The sons of, not of Yaakov, because Yaakov is just a person. Where the sons of Yisrael, that's the nation, that's the whole, right? This is the beginning of the whole, the beginning of the nation. So this little mitzvah represents a very significant story, because the moment he changes from Yaakov to Yisrael is we have the next stage in the growth of the Jewish people. Okay, and that's what we've been talking about. We start off with Pru Urvu. We start off with kind of this global mitzvah. Then we have the mitzvah of Brit Milah, which is the beginnings of the Jewish people. That's Avraham's first commitment to Hashem. That's when we begin to have a uniqueness. And then when we transition from individual to peoplehood, right? Now we're not just the family, the small tribe, the small family. Now we're becoming a people, a nation. That moment is happening right here and right now. When Yaakov spiritually and physically is able to stand up to the direct adversary and say, I'm going to take the hit and I'm not giving this up. Right? This angel thinks it can change Yaakov, it can defeat Yaakov, it can convince Yaakov to give up his religion. And when the message is clear, no, that's not happening. You can try to injure me, but that's not happening. So from that point forward, we have a straight line where the Jewish people are being built generation by generation by generation, right? And that becomes the future. Now we have to realize, Yaakov is concerned at the beginning of this parsha that his family is going to be decimated.
Right? He was blessed by his dad with the opposite, that his family was going to be fruitful, that he was going to be the nation. So Why would he have that fear?
Well, you're right. He definitely has that that confidence that Hashem will come through. But there, and we see this a few times in Yaakov's life, that he needed certain things to happen, or to, his faith in Hashem grew step by step, right? I mean, Rashi points out that when Yosef was born, when Joseph was born, Rashi says, and then Jacob believed in God. That until he had a child with Rachel, there was something gnawing at him. His faith was not as secure as it was later on. And when he's able to defeat Esav and conquer that, he's able to move on to the next stage in life. And, you know, people's lives are like that. There are certain things that are holding you back. Certain moments when you're able to overcome something, or a person that's intimidating you or holding you back, when you're able to move past that, now a whole new world opens up for you. And that's kind of Yaakov's life here. A whole new world now opens up for him. And now he is a straight line. You know, and now after his encounter with Esav is not a factor anymore. He's not afraid anymore. Now again, there's more trials and tribulations, but now it's pretty much a chronologically, generation after generation after generation. So, yeah.
Does it make sense that an angel who is the servant of God would want to defeat Jacob's belief in God or commitment to God?
Well, sure, if we understand this as a test. If we understand this as a test for Jacob to prove to himself and to prove to others that that he's got the mettle to be the leader of this people. Yeah, I mean, I think that makes sense.
That's why he's alone. Actually, maybe protecting the family.
Right, and that's the other thing, right? I didn't talk about that, but right, the fact that he's alone, he's got this whole family, but this happens, it's a solitary moment for him.
Yeah.
Right. It's a one-on-one, a mano-a-mano battle, and, you know, he's got to get his mind right. He has to make sure he's completely secure in who he is and what he's doing before he's able to encounter Esav. So when he encounters Esav after the story, he's ready. He's not just ready physically, he's ready psychologically, he's ready spiritually, he's ready mentally. He's got to be at the place where he's ready to take Esav on in all ways. And he's not afraid of him, right? When Yaakov knows, you know what? There's nothing Esav can do to hurt me, right? I'm going to survive, my children are going to survive, as a people we're going to survive. Esav can't defeat me. He can hurt me. He can make my life more difficult, but he can't wipe me out. And when Yaakov really, to his core, believes that, you know, it's a very different confrontation with Esau. Because when you know that the other person can't wipe you out, you know, you're not as scared anymore. And when he's not scared of Esau, he's already won half the battle. Okay.
Is this struggle a premonition about how his meeting with Esau would go?
Well, you could say it's a premonition. You could say it's a training ground, right? He's this is his sparring partner, right, to a certain extent. He deals with it. He deals with it in advance. He's forced to deal with it in advance. So that when he encounters Esav, he's not as afraid. And you see, when he meets Esav, he's got the way it's described, he's got a certain calm about him that he doesn't have at the beginning of the Parsha. Beginning of the Parsha, he's nervous, he's scared. He wants to separate his family into two camps. So if Esav wipes out one of the camps, the other one will survive. That's fear. When he encounters Esav, he doesn't seem to have the same fear anymore. And this story really seems to play that out. Seems to prepare him for that encounter. Okay, I want to move on just to get to how this applies to us. So, obviously we don't need a mitzvah to tell us that we should all injure ourselves and our thighs to represent this story. We obviously didn't admit to telling us not to eat other people's sciatic nerves. Right? Although the question does come up. And it's a bit of a side note, but... Well, there's a whole question of... I don't know if I... I'll bring this up, but it's inside. But there's a question that's brought up, and the Minchas Chinuch discusses this here, of cannibalism. Right? Obviously, you can eat another person. But is human meat not kosher? Okay? You're stuck in a desert island, and someone dies. can you eat them? Right, if you have, you know, can you eat them? So his whole question is: it prohibited from the Torah, or prohibited only midrabbanan rabbinically? Nowhere explicitly does the Torah say don't eat other people, right? Obviously, if it's murder, it's murder. You can't. But let's say it's not murder. So the question then comes up: well, if it's not prohibited from the Torah, is eating a person's sciatic nerve prohibited from the Torah? Someone applied to animals. So that question comes up. But let's not focus on that. Maybe I'll edit that part out. Anyway, so what? Yeah. So, but obviously the focus here is an animal. So we want to remember this. We want to remember the story, and we want to So we want the story to remain prevalent in not only what we do, but it becomes prevalent in what we practice. When something becomes a mitzvah, it obviously has a deeper impact on us because it now becomes part of who we are. So we saw that the Brit Milah becomes part of who we are because of the importance of the mitzvah, but not only the importance of it, but as we described last week, it almost had to be passed down from generation to generation because its very purpose was to establish a covenant. Avram's establishing a covenant for future generations. So what he does, they have to do as well to as a sign that they are accepting that same covenant upon themselves. So to here, as we're transitioning from individual to people, this becomes a symbol of the Jewish people. And what Yaakov goes through ends up becoming a symbol of his battle and our battle to how we encounter the world around us. Those who try to either defeat us, try to kill us, or just try to convince us to live a different way of life or a different religion. So that becomes the focus of it. So therefore, when we don't eat the Gid HaNasha, then that ends up symbolizing that. So, where is the Gid HaNasha? So now take out your little pictures here. So, I have a picture, the top one is from the human body, and the bottom one is from the animal, from a cow. So here we have just a sense. It goes all the way, basically, it almost connects the midpoint, the torso, all the way down through the leg. So it's a very long nerve, and it's found in the hind, the back of a person. So when it comes to an animal in the bottom, it basically is in the hind quarters of the animal, stretching almost from the top all the way down. So if you look at the picture, this is a picture of the different cuts of meat. A side view of a cow. So it could be interesting anyway. So it starts in the tenderloin, right? Nice San Francisco term, right? Right? All bad things start in the tenderloin. So the tenderloin, so in the tenderloin is where you have the sciatic nerve, and that's where filet mignon comes from. Comes from the tenderloin, and then the hindquarters.
But does the nerve go through the loin?
Through the tenderloin, I believe so. I believe it goes into that part of the animal.
Does it go all the way down to the bottom, sir?
It goes down. I think it goes in through the round.
Where exactly?
My understanding. Well, in the tenderloin.
Where's
the nerve? I don't have a. I'm just sketching it out.
So it's sirloin pressure.
Sirloin, yeah, I believe sirloin is for sure.
But if you remove sciatic nerve from the filet mignon, then filet mignon.
Okay, right, so here's the question. So the question is, why don't we just remove it, right? The prohibition is eating the sciatic nerve, not eating that part of the animal. Now, there's some other issues as well. There's certain fats in an animal that are kosher, certain fats are not kosher, they're called chaylev. And those are more commonly found in the hindquarters of the animal, so that's an issue as well. But when it comes to the sciatic nerve, so why don't we just take it out? So there is a way to take it out. And there's a process called nikur acharayim, rendering the hindquarters of an animal fit for kosher consumption. And it's got a very long history. And I'll just go through kind of historically different perspectives on it. Do you have a question?
Yeah, I think I was learning that, I guess there's an inner and an outer. One is Minotaur and one is Rabbanan.
Yeah, there's a few. Yeah, there's a few different ones. Yeah, there's one that's Minotaur, one that's rabbinic. Right. Right.
Sciatic nerve is routinely removed, and it's difficult, but it's done. And The meat is fine.
Right.
Is it routine?
Well, that's why you could get filet mignon in Israel, and it's kosher.
You can get it in a kosher restaurant in New York.
There are some. It's, right. Well, it's
and pay $100.
The biggest issue is that it's not a simple process. It's a very
difficult process.
It's a difficult process, and it has to be. It's an exacting process that requires a lot of expertise.
But once it's removed properly, then filet mignon is kosher. It's fine. It's
right. Exactly. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. No.
I
played it up in the beginning. That filet
mignon. I just thought I.
Yeah. No. So it is kosher. It's potentially kosher, but it's a very difficult process. There are a few people, leading rabbis through the years, who have said that the hindquarters are not kosher altogether, but pretty much everyone agrees that it is. It's just a question of how common a practice was it. So throughout history, we have a lot of different sources that go through different stringencies. So, for example, on the Yom Shel Shlomo, Rabbi Shlomo Luria, 1510 to 1574, so he writes that he would not eat the hindquarters until a second person would check that the first one was done correctly, meaning it was such a difficult process that that he was very careful not to do it. But there are certain points in history when either they didn't have experts in the field who could do it, or just was seen as too difficult to even try. So they didn't. So the Radbaz, who was writing in Egypt, he lived from 1479 to 1573, so he mentions that their custom was to just sell the hindquarters to the Muslims. They felt like it was not worth it. It wasn't worth it. They didn't bother with it. And you have a lot of communities who historically also, they would just sell it to the non-Jews. That Tzemach Tzedek, one of the beginning of the Lubavitch movement, so he writes the same thing. There are a lot of the Chavos Yair writing in Germany, 1638 to 1702. So he also says that basically what they would do is sell the hindquarters to non-Jews. But there are many people who discuss this, people who, in communities that it was very common that they would take out the sciatic nerve. It just became required an expertise, and there are people who could do it. So
you could have benefit from it, but you can't eat it.
And there's a whole question about can you receive benefit from, but it seems to be that you can. Really, just basar v'chalav. It's really just meat and milk that was mixed together that we can't have benefit from. But non kosher meat, you can have benefit from, right? If you shecht an at, it's common that they'll shecht an animal at a kosher slaughtering house, and either they realize they didn't shecht it correctly, or they'll discover that the animal, something was wrong with the animal, wouldn't have survived 12 months. Then they just sell those to non-kosher plants. Mm. So that's very common. So basically the same thing here. There's a lot of writings that that it was a use. So Rabbi Jonas and Eibschitz, who lived from 1690 to 1764. So he writes that it was just very difficult. So he himself, he was one of the leading rabbis of his generation, he himself was able to do this practice. He was a menacher, that's what it's called. So he writes that he would only eat the hindquarters if he himself had taken it out. That's he felt it was such a difficult process. Let me read the history, it's interesting. In London, Nikor was first introduced, the removing of the Gidin Nasha, by the London Board of Shechita in 1827. It seems that housewives were not happy with the appearance of the porged meat. It was very obvious after they took this out, they had to really butcher the meat, quote-unquote, right? It didn't look the same. It didn't look very good. Butchers tried to satisfy their demands by selling unporged hindquarters. In 1865, the tensions between the board, the butchers, and the housewives reached such levels that a representative was sent to observe the methods of Nikor practiced in Leghorn, Italy, and in Paris, in the hopes that Nikor was done there in a neater manner. Unfortunately, there were no differences in the methods. Ultimately, it's going to look the same. The conflict between the housewives, the butchers, and the board continued for decades. Eventually, the board licensed only certain butchers to sell hindquarters. This led to other problems, and in 1912 and again in 1923, special campaigns were initiated to educate the public about the importance of Nikor and to enforce the regulations. Sometime after 1929, the Beitin of the board prohibited the sale of hindquarters, though some Nikor apparently continued in London until at least 1941. In 1941, Rabbi Yecheskel Abramsky supported Rabbi Binyamin banish Atlas of Glasgow and rejecting the butcher's request to sell hindquarters. His concern was that it would lead to problems of supervision. The issue arose again in 2000 when the Israeli chain El Gaucho, you have heard of the El Gaucho restaurants in Jerusalem?
Yeah.
So they sought to open a kosher branch in London and to serve hindquarters as it does in Yerushalayim. The Beit Din of the board eventually turned the store down. And they were, I think, the first restaurants in Yerushalayim to attempt to sell this type of meat. And they were able to, I think they have certain steaks, I think.
Yeah, porterhouse.
Is that what it is?
Yeah, which is like half filet, half shell.
Okay, so.
Half what?
Shell.
Is it expensive? It must be pretty expensive then.
Yeah, I mean, this was, 25 years ago.
So, right. Yeah, so
it's more expensive today, I guess.
Probably.
Yeah, so, but so they're a restaurant that, so that's just a bit of a, an example of it. This is coming from the OU's website. I got this story from.
This wasn't that an issue in America.
So here they have a little bit about America as well, but doesn't seem like there was ever a real attempt in America. So then the OU supervises Nikor of deer hindquarters in the United States because in deer, only the Gidonash and blood require removal, but not the chaylev. And that's what ends up being a bigger deal also, is that they not only have to remove the sciatic nerve, but also a lot of the fats, and so it becomes much more complicated. So in America, I don't think there's ever been like a mass movement to be able to use these hindquarters.
Is there any reason for that? Maybe that part of the calf retain more blood than any other meat.
Say it again?
That part of the meat.
Yeah.
Sustain more blood.
The blood is easy. I mean, the blood is taken out the same way through all animals. I mean,
some part is easier to take it out than others.
I don't think that, I haven't seen that's the issue. The issue.
Okay.
No. Yeah.
I'm just asking.
Yeah. Now, it's interesting because sometimes this issue is portrayed as a Sephardic versus Ashkenazic thing. That Sephardim say that you can. When my wife and I were in our process of wedding planning, we went to a restaurant, to a hotel, and they asked us, do we want filet mignon? And they said to us, I mean, they weren't Jewish. There's people that said, well, Sephardim believe that you can remove the Gid Hanash, the sciatic nerve, and Ashkenazim say you can't. So are you Sephardi or Ashkenazi?
Yeah.
Right? But that kind of becomes that. That's
who is a better butcher?
Yeah, right? So that's kind of become the way some people describe the issue, but that doesn't seem to be the case at all. Historically, Ashkenazim and Sephardim have both done it. It's just a question of time and place, and if as a community they had the people who could do it, and if it was worth their time and effort to do it.
Supply demand issue.
Yeah, basically that's all it is.
You lived in New York. You went to YU, right?
Yeah.
You go to La Marais, you have the best filet mignon. And
yes, so in New York you can find it. Yeah, yeah. I don't know exactly where. I haven't.
What about appearance?
What?
What about appearance? If you look like you're eating a filet mignon, I'm trying to remember. It's the same reason why we don't have chicken.
Well,
sorry, the same reason why we don't mix chicken with dairy.
With dairy, right. Well,
look like you're eating meat.
Well, there it's pretty clear what you're eating. It's just a question of, you're right, was it removed? Since there's a viable way to eat it, there's no reason for people to assume that you did it in the improper way. If it's ham, that's a different story. But since there's a way to do it that's kosher, then doesn't make it invalid. People are going to assume that you're going to eat it. Yeah.
Is there also the difference of just utility? If there's no one to give the meat to or sell the meat to, you don't want to waste it. So in such a community, you would want to remove the...
I feel like you could always sell the meat to non-Jews. No, meat always has a market now. I think.
Because my mother said in Poland they could get it.
They could get it.
That butchers would do it.
Yeah, I mean, but yeah.
She said here the butchers wouldn't do it. It was too expensive.
Right, it's too expensive. It wasn't worth their while. Right, exactly. So obviously, maybe in Europe, it was worth their while, I guess, or I don't know.
Maybe they're better at it. So affluent that they didn't waste their time.
Yeah.
The American butchers might not have been trained to the same extent. Yeah.
They're trained fine.
I don't know. My Zadie's a butcher, so I wish I could ask him what he did. I don't know. But he was a butcher.
It's done routinely.
What?
It's done.
No, it's definitely done today, for sure. I don't know exactly what the, how often they're done, but they're definitely done. Yeah.
It's done.